GeekSpeak with Lyle Troxell, a show exploring the intersection of humanity and technology coming from the fringes of Silicon Valley. Today's episode is Japanese Teapot Maps Super Mario. Days after the launch of the world's smallest orbital rocket, SpaceX is set to launch a Tesla Roadster into space. Meanwhile, Strava has accidentally mapped out secret bases around the world. And the slow-mo guys demonstrated the differences in TV technology at 380,000 frames per second. These stories and more on this week's GeekSpeak.
Hello, I'm Lyle Troxell, and in the air room with me is Mr. Miles Cullen Elam. He's a programmer, father, a political junkie, farmer. Hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Quite well, thank you. Thanks for joining me today. I'm very excited that you could have smart glasses and not be a glass hole. Intel is producing a whole chipset for intelligent glasses, basically glasses that give you a heads-up display, where it doesn't have a camera, so no creep factor like Google Glass, and no big like monkey thing in front of your eyeball that everybody can see. It just paints with a laser onto your retina, so no bad, all good. It's monochrome.
Paints with a laser directly under your eyeball. What could possibly go wrong with that?
Exactly. I mean, of course, it's a very low-level laser, low-power laser, and it stimulates your retina directly. And it actually bounces off a holographic reflector inside the lens. And you can get the lenses to work for a prescription. So even someone like you could have them, Miles. Isn't that exciting? I miss Google Glass. I mean, I did like having the heads-up display. And I've been trying to convince myself to get a watch, but nada.
I don't want to watch either.
All right, so tell me about Japan.
Japan has launched the world's smallest rocket capable of carrying a satellite into orbit. It's only about the size of a typical utility pole. So
the size of the rocket, not the
size of the rocket. Yeah, so oh, cool. 10 meters in length, 50 centimeters in diameter.
It almost sounds like a home rocket. I mean, that's small.
Yeah. But it could actually
large, big rocket, but yeah.
But as you get really small satellites, like the little
CubeSats.
Yeah, CubeSats. Mm-hmm. That's and things of its nature, you're able to get that up there. So
I wonder if it's more efficient to have a larger rocket with more fuel and a larger payload versus a smaller. I'm assuming that the larger, the more efficient it is in fuel usage, but I'm not sure.
Yeah, I don't know. That's
so they just,
I think the problem is rocket science.
They just did this. They just launched their first satellite successfully.
Yes,
that's pretty cool.
Successful,
what is the
yeah.
Japanese space agency called?
The Japan Aerospace Exploration Agency.
Cool.
Although that would be the English translation,
of course. I'm not asking you for Japanese. But speaking of English space flight, Elon Musk has done something fun too.
Yeah, going in the other direction. SpaceX has been working on their Falcon Heavy, so a very large rocket, something that can be used to send payloads to other planetary bodies, for example.
So the Falcon that we're used to, where that can land again, its second stage or first stage unit can now land back on a carrier. We've been talking about that for a long time, a barge. This Heavy is larger than that, quite a bit larger than that.
Yes, the idea being that it wouldn't just send, payloads into near Earth orbit, such as the International Space Station, but send stuff to geosynchronous orbit in a single push, which is actually the main drive to this launch. There actually will be payloads from the Air Force, for example, on there.
And geosynchronous, of course, is highly useful because you stay in the same rotation as Earth, so the satellite always stays above you.
Exactly.
On one point on Earth.
But after it drops its payload off, if everything goes correctly, then it will be sending one of Elon Musk's Tesla Roadsters off into deep space as far as they can get toward Mars.
Wait, why? That seems like such a waste. Why send a car?
Well, for showman's purposes, yeah.
Okay, sure, so it's a marketing endeavor.
Totally is. I mean, he owns Tesla, so like, what's an extra car to him?
Yeah, but it seems like you could send something that would be a little more useful. Though he does say that it's not...
The thing is, Elon Musk was saying that the Falcon Heavy has a 50-50 chance of success.
Okay.
And that's him being very...
optimistic.
Well, yeah. Right.
So if you spend a lot of money to create a really great ship that's going to go to Mars and take pictures or something that would be highly useful, all that expense might be just burned up when the rocket fails to launch.
Right. And you want to see how far you can send something, so something that has some mass to it, which is the whole point of the Falcon Heavy. So you take something that's a known quantity of mass that you're not too worried that is going to go away, and you track to see how far it got.
And since he has to send something that's large in mass and it has a high availability of failure, it's going to be hard to find somebody that's going to pay for a payload. So let's just do something that's heavy. Hey, I've got a car, and that's a good marketing stunt.
Yeah. Well, the geosynchronous satellites are, you know,
will those also be in the payload, or that later plan?
Those are in the payload.
Okay.
The idea behind them is that it is if you have a rocket that is not as well tested, if you have a fair number of failures, that goes into the overall launch costs. The fact that there's a certain amount that are going to be failures, so you have your prices relative to factor that in. So the idea is you get that stuff in geostationary orbit. If that's the case, then that's a success. But there's also the question of exactly how far, how well the whole thing can perform. And that's where you want to have the thing that you just don't care as much about. Now, a Roadster, obviously, to you and me, that would have some value. That'd be a cool thing to have. But at the same time, for Elon Musk, like from his point of view, from SpaceX point of view, if the Roadster is lost,
not a big deal.
If it's gained, if it everything is successful, that means you have bragging rights of a Roadster, branded Roadster of your own design, going around the sun in an orbit in between Earth and Mars that you could, you know, point to, you could always reference. It's a reasonably good marketing tool.
I think you should have sent a really big teapot.
That understands HTTP requests and responds to a 415. Yeah.
Actually, definitely. What is the 415 again?
I am a teapot. Yeah. I think it's 415.
So when describe that joke to everybody besides you and me.
Well, there's the philosophical notion of Russell's teapot, and that is
a classic conundrum of philosophy, right?
Well, it's describing why you cannot prove a negative. Logically, so when someone says you can't prove a negative, this is what they mean, that someone could say, I believe that there is a teapot in orbit, you know,
it's like really
Mars,
far out there. It's actually much farther than that. It's like out near Pluto or something. This is teapot. But anyways, it doesn't really matter where it is.
And so you go, oh, well, can I see this teapot? Well, it's really small. It'd be hard for any telescopes to see it. Well, what if we had a telescope? Well, you have to know exactly where to look for it, and I don't know where the orbit is. So you make all these different things, but you say
all these caveats that make it really hard to have any.
Right. But you assert there's a teapot there. The person who's trying to disprove it can't disprove it easily because
the caveats
are difficult.
That
negative.
Sure.
Like, wait, but the onus is on the person making the claim of there's a teapot there to say affirmatively, not negatively, that there's a teapot, and here it is.
Right. Okay, and so because of that teapot thing, there's a whole bunch of cases in computer science that they use teapots for objects. So, for example, that one of the actually pretty interesting three-dimensional rendering is of a teapot. And a teapot has an interesting shape because of the handle. So it's actually a hard 3D model to get correct. And so that's a base, there's a base model that is a teapot model that most 3D engines use as a test model to render, which is kind of cool. And then this example is when people were developing the HTTP protocol, which is how web pages...
No, this was not developing. This came much later.
Oh, okay.
And actually, I misspoke. It wasn't 415, it's 418.
Specifically, but everyone probably knows what a 404 is. When you get to a website that's not there, the status code for that from the server to the browser is the page doesn't exist, this resource doesn't exist. That status code is 404. And then there's 200s, which are means it's successful in some way. Most of the time you don't see other status codes. Sometimes you'll see a 500. That means the server had a problem.
There's 304, which is...
redirected.
Your cache is valid.
Is valid. Yeah. But some of these status codes you won't see as an end user. You'll see as a developer. Right. But 404 you'll see as an end user. 500 you'll sometimes see as an end user.
Yeah.
And you said 418 is MIT pod? I assume it was a 200. Why is it a 4?
Well, it's an April Fool's joke. 418 came about 10 years ago or so because of an April Fool's joke.
We've finished this, right? We're done?
Yes, we have. Although there's a part of me that just wants to say, like, because I've been working on Node, mm-hmm. Doing a patch for them, and it's kind of growing
about
a little bit.
About status codes?
Well, yeah, but it's growing a little bit, and it just reminds me
Did you write the test that they asked you to write?
I did. Oh, but good. To write the test, I had to write a server portion that could generate it, which then required a whole extra set of vetting, and then it, yeah, it's
been complicated.
Going somewhere. But, 100 codes are informational.
So you think the teapot would be the 100 code? You mean 108?
No, but 100 means it's not the final end point. It's right. Something that happens in the middle. Like a 100 is actually saying continue. Like, okay, yeah, you can continue on and the actual response will come later. 200 status codes are, as you said, like, yeah, here's your payload, here's your content, here's everything's okay. 300 is do something special, you know, redirect or this cache.
Check headers. That kind of thing.
400 class codes are basically you did something wrong. And when I say you did something wrong, that means from the server point of view, you ask for something
that wasn't...
The client
has done something odd.
Right.
Okay.
500 is the server did something wrong. Database went down.
Sure.
Something like that. And that's those are all the status codes.
That was fun.
Yeah. Well,
thanks, Miles.
It's geek speak, and I don't know. I just never have a chance to ever really talk about that, and I guess now I know why.
Well, what's it like? Okay, so Node has become like 5 years ago when I got seriously into JavaScript. I was got really engaged in the Node community when I worked at 4D. We had a server side JavaScript implementation, so I kind of got involved in the server side of JavaScript, and because it's my language of most use in my lifetime, it was pretty exciting. Node, of course, is a server-side JavaScript implementation. JavaScript is what the browser uses as a runtime, a programming mm-hmm. language. And Node's become very popular. It's now kind of driving a lot of back-end servers and such. In fact, if you go to walmart.com, you get Node as the system that serves all the content. And you just recently, you're working on a patch right now to actually fix a fundamental flaw in Node.
Yeah, well, a spec violation, but yeah.
Yeah, well, I think that's a flaw. It's not
when you say fundamental flaw, that's usually like, oh my God, the server is going to fall over.
I guess from this perspective, it's shocking to me that the de facto, I mean, Node is like one of the things that's been so nice about it is it's a very good light server implementation. When I talk about server, mm-hmm. HTTP server, like that's a major use of it is some stacks on top of it, basically, to have a good HTTP server, a web server. And it not being compliant with HTTP seems like a pretty big miss. So that you caught that and fixing it is kind of cool.
Yeah. Well, the reason that I caught it was because we happened to touch an edge case that did that.
Because nobody else uses status 100s is what you're saying.
Well, status 100 would have been fine. We were hitting a status 102.
What's that one?
Means processing. That is, there's something going on. I don't have an answer for you yet. So here's this intermediate
it's
status code to tell you don't close the connection, don't time out.
It kind of sounds like a keep alive, but in a different way. It's a non
right. It's like a keep alive, except the server is saying, "Hey, I'm still working on this." Just basically telling the browser, "Don't give up on this."
A keep alive works such that your browser requests something from the server and then also does a keep alive and then asks again for something and again for something, right?
The idea is you're keeping the socket alive. Yeah, that way you don't have to close the socket and then reopen a new one. You can just use the same socket channel.
How is that different in HTTP2 connections?
HTTP2 for a specific client to a specific server, instead of having multiple connections go out, you're typically working on a single connection that is multiplexing the different streams. Mm-hmm. So instead of getting four different sockets to get, you know, the main HTML, the CSS, the JavaScript, and images, it's a single stream that can figure out which part of the byte stream is going to be for the interstitial image.
Has anyone
the main head image?
Is anyone taking advantage of the idea of the server saying here's an HTTP file and here's the CSS file it references without the client parsing the HTML and then requesting CSS? That was the promise of HTTP2. Has that actually been implemented?
That's part of HTTP2, known as push.
Uh-huh.
And it's there, but in practice, people have had a great deal of difficulty with it. Because one of the things about HTTP is that you can cache a lot.
Yeah.
The fastest request is the request you don't have to make.
Meaning I visited GeekSpeak before. There was a CSS document, which is a style sheet document. I got a copy of it. The next day I come back to the server and I ask for HTML. And the server doesn't know I already have a copy of that CSS file. So there's no reason for the server to send it, but it wouldn't know not to send it. That's the problem you're talking about.
Right. The browser goes, hey, if this file has been modified since I last saw it, then send it to me. Otherwise, send back what we were talking about before, HTTP status code. Send me back a 304 saying that it's still the same.
Right.
And so that would save time. You can't really do that with HTTP to push because the server doesn't have that information about what the client has in their cache. So you could start the push and say, hey, here's this other stuff. And then the client has to proactively, after the stream already starts, go, oh, wait, no, I already have this. Yeah, stop sending me.
All right, well, thanks for the status code stuff. That was fun to talk about. Let's move on. Miles, you know, I'm assuming, who Mick Mulvaney is?
I don't.
Ah, he is the head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, put in place by Trump administration. And he is slowed, sources say, he is slowed and basically stalling any investigation into the Equifax September announcement of the 143 million Americans data hacked event that occurred. Hit the news really strong, but it looks like Consumer Financial Protection, the CFPB, has stopped investigating and stopped, basically put it on a down low, not looking into it anymore, which is really discouraging, of course, because one of the things that came of this, like my optimistic mind went, oh good, these financial institutions that are, you know, these giant credit agencies really messed up. We'll get good legislation in place. We'll fix this problem. We'll start thinking better about how you control data. And that has already, you know, it's now February and investigation's lulling and I feel beaten a bit.
Yeah, it's much the same thing as the announcement in December 2017 that the current administration would not prosecute HSBC, the bank that was caught red-handed laundering money for drug lords,
mm-hmm.
that they are not going to pursue any future charges against them.
That's ridiculous. Okay, so Equifax is not totally in the clear, though, because they are under investigation by every state attorney general, and they face over 240 class action lawsuits. So the corporation is being chewed at, but it feels to me there's a possibility here for a better structure of this kind of financial checking of people. In any case, a little frustrating, so let's move on. Miles, tell me about another kind of massive data release that was actually intentional but had some bad side effects.
Intentional for some parties, not for others. If you are, if you have one of those tracking apps for like how far you've run during the day, like your trail running and being able to look at that, that is aggregated by some corporations to be able to generate heat maps to go like, hey, here's where everyone is using our app. This is a very common thing, not just for that type of thing, but any interaction that people had to be able to show a heat map, like where our users are. And mm-hmm. Typically that isn't all that useful to say like, where would our app be really useful? Let's see the heat map for where it goes. And it generally is a one-to-one representation for a population map. In other words, lo and behold, there's a whole lot of people in New York City and yeah. LA and not many people in Cheyenne, Wyoming.
Right. You also saw things like you'd zoom into a place that had a high school track or college track, and you saw that there was lots of people coming into the parking lot and then getting out of their car and then going around the track multiple times and coming back, right? That thing is an obvious example. In a place where people are working out, they're definitely going to have that app on and they're going to collect the data.
Right. Sure. Now, the drawback here are folks that maybe shouldn't be using that app but hadn't thought about it because they were just tracking their own data. But, for example, there are some man-made islands being created in the South China Sea by China to try to extend their territorial waters.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't necessarily want to tell people about them while they're in process. They want to be able to stake the claim after all is said and done. So they have, you know, building up military bases there. And some of the people that are on those bases have been conducting an exercise regimen.
Sure.
And some of those people conducting an exercise regimen have these, you know, trail running apps. Yeah. And the company that runs them generates a heat map of where everyone is running. And so these heat maps are showing up, for example, in the South China Sea or in other places where they were otherwise secret bases.
Or, yeah, I mean,
or places did not want to be their location known.
Right. And basically, you know, you take, you know, 20-something-year-olds and you have them in the military and you have them work out all the time, a lot of them are going to have these apps tracking their movement, because then they get to figure out how much they ran and keep track of their energy, because they're into fitness, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so you have a whole bunch of our secret bases basically being outed. And not just that, the actual paths of travel in around those areas. So roads basically that weren't mapped before are now being mapped. And a lot of data that people didn't want public is public. Now, the thing that's interesting about the military thing, though, is you would assume that okay, so you're an elite fighting force, right? You have a whole bunch of troops.
Mm-hmm.
You definitely don't want all of them to wear GPS systems and send that data to some third party. That's insane. Yep. And I get that if you're in combat, that's very different than in training, right? I mean, definitely get that idea. That I'm sure there's places in the United States where it's like, you know, it doesn't matter that anybody knows our training regiment. You could track them the entire time. But just the general idea of saying, oh, yeah, it's fine. Go ahead and wear something that tracks you and sends that data remotely. Additionally, though, we've seen, you know, we've seen large companies or military or government try to make tech that is up to par with what you can get at the Apple store. And they just can't beat it, right? You can't beat that high-end commercial level mass-produced thing that Apple and Sony are making for watches and phones and like that.
It's all levels of the government. I mean, we've got a president that uses an Android phone that is definitely not hardened in order to...
Woefully insecure.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's pretty bad. I mean, I've seen a lot of the, you know, analysis of how bad this is, but is the company facing any legal action?
I don't see how the company should be held culpable for it. That's something that I don't see that angle. Especially because one of the things you would want to do for your users is have it be anonymous. That you're just sending, you know, geo data, but you're not tying it to a particular user. So if you're not tying it to a particular user, how do you know who the user is and what role they play?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. So here's one of the quotes. Tobias Schneider pointed out a short route near the headquarters of the United Kingdom's Signals Intelligence Organization, GCHQ, at Benhall, called Snowden's Way, attempted more than 2,000 times by 573 people. So getting close to, basically, like, finding out exactly how many people have taken a certain path.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And of course, this data, though it is anonymized, at some level, there's not that much anonymity, because those people are at those locations, and you have information of tracking information, right? So you can rebuild some information from us, another source, and then use that tracking information to find people. So it's not exact. I mean, it's anonymous in the sense you don't know where all the dots are, but if you start picking up paths, and then you start looking at cameras on those paths and pick up a face, pick up another location, you can start relocating it. I remember when much prior to me being at Netflix, there was this example of kind of a data breach problem with Netflix did this big contest to help get a better algorithm to predict people's play history.
Mm-hmm.
We did actually pay out $1 million, I think, for it, but this was a long time ago.
But didn't end up using the algorithm.
That's
It wasn't worth it to retool.
That's right. We actually implemented other things. It moved quite a bit further than that. I'm not in the algorithm team, so I don't know much about it. But at the time, we released, you know, anonymized play information, and somebody actually took a look at that play history of just, you know, individuals, what they've watched. That's all it was, and not actually all the data, and no names, obviously. And then just correlated it to, I think it was Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb ratings of what people liked with accounts, right? So you have an account over at Rotten Tomatoes or IMDb, and you've rated like 50 movies you've watched, right? And then you have this giant database of titles that people have watched, and all you have to do is find someone that's watched in one set of data the same as the other, right? And then all of a sudden you've correlated a name. So it is extremely hard to, we don't release that kind of data anymore. Mm-hmm. We did that once, and I think we've learned a lesson. I should talk to somebody about it that'll find out, you know, what the decision was. But it's really hard to make real anonymous data. Anyway, big mistake. I'm glad they're not doing that anymore. Or I should say, I'm assuming they won't release it anymore. Are you saying, though, that it's nothing that they did? The company shouldn't really be in trouble for releasing this data because it was totally in their right?
Like I said, it's that notion of if you are trying to get this data anonymously, if you're not trying to collate it. The whole point to these apps is that you are recording it. So that you can make a comparison. So it has to have a user ID associated with it. It has to have that information. With regard to publishing a heat map, it's not like someone had the intent. Mm-hmm. You know, it'd be pretty hard to prove intent to say, like, yes, we wanted to out these secret bases. I think very much it was some coder and somewhere in, you know, in some tech center saying, hey, let's make a heat map. And then the more people show up, you can start pointing to it and have your company say, like, hey, this is how many people are using it. And we're a global society. So I could see, government entities saying, hey, I want you to exclude these areas from your heat map that actually gets published. But I just don't see the intent required for a lawsuit to come to play.
I can assume that people that want to keep secrets would be getting better at having their staff not wear these types of devices, not have tracking devices on them. You know, this kind of brings up an example of a problem I keep on having with intelligent home devices, and I mean like light bulbs and cameras of things of that nature. We have friends that live up the river from us in Boulder Creek, and they have a really cool trail camera. And it's a motion sensor camera that sits outside, and anytime somebody goes by it, it records near it, right? And they caught this wonderful footage of a mountain lion, because we've got mountain lions outside here. And I was like, oh, I want to do that too. I want to see if we can find, because we're pretty, about half a mile from each other, but the terrain between us has no obstructions except for river. And so I wanted to do one too. But I started looking into them, and they're all online connected. And of course you want them online connected, right? You want them to connect to Wi-Fi, upload the images, it's easy to see it. And then I also can do motion detection either in hardware or up on the server. I mean, there's a lot more options when you do that. Mm-hmm. But I have decided that buying whole bunch of fun devices for my home that just become botnets or lose my, privacy is just not worth the trade. And this heat tracking, this tracking of where you run and stuff, it is really convenient. I grant you, if you run a lot, having that kind of thing is great. And you are trading something while you do that.
So let me ask you, do you have any Amazon devices that...
I have two Amazon devices. I have an Amazon Echo. Does she light up? An Amazon Dot. And I do like them. I think they're cool. I've said this before on the show. I pay for Google Play in the music store, the music service, which also gives you YouTube without commercials, which is kind of the reason why I do it. But Amazon won't let me play that through Amazon. So even though I have unlimited music through Google, I can't play it on the devices that are connected to our home stereo.
How is this thinking an always-on microphone in your home?
Yeah.
And connected to a corporate network.
Totally granted. It does have a trigger word, and it's not sending data until it hears that trigger word, but then it does start recording as soon as that happens, and it does send
it. It is currently not. There is nothing in firmware that could prevent it from
granted.
Doing so.
And I have a little bit more faith in the security of Amazon for their devices than I do for some random security camera. In fact, one of the reasons I'm thinking of maybe getting one of these trail cams by a big company is to have a bit of protection on it. But I think that no one's really focusing on this problem.
So as I fully don my my tinfoil hat and make sure it's securely on.
Please do.
I can't help but think of it is impossible basically nowadays without with our modern society to listen to a piece of music without someone knowing it and being able to track it, like that notion of being able to put a tape into your car deck, that type of thing is
FM radio is still happening. CDs still exist.
It is, and at the same time, things are moving because you have the Bluetooth integration with your car. And so if you turn on Pandora or Spotify or Apple Music or Amazon Music, then that becomes a tracked series of stream data, as opposed to you bought a CD. And especially like if I bought a CD at a flea market, like it's completely untrackable. It's a very different dynamic to our society.
It is. We have the benefit of not having to shuffle CDs and figure out and buy one and keep the inventory and all that stuff. We just have it all on our devices and it's really easy, or we're paying some small fee to get as much music as we possibly want. But with that trade-off is that giant privacy problem. And I agree, there's a serious issue here. I've been, you know, thinking about wanting more home automation type stuff, but I keep on getting blocked with, the more I buy into that, the more I'm sharing my data. And I know I could build a system that wouldn't share the data remotely, that would all be local, but I got to build it myself, and I just don't have the interest. But it feels like there is a small market that's starting that wants the benefit of these features, but also wants the privacy highly enforced. Mm-hmm. And I'm not seeing that explode. I'm not seeing that named. But as soon as there's a marketing name on that, and as soon as the specs are, we do not call for home ever. You know, this is how things are. We need Wi-Fi, but we do not. But we have all our ports blocked from outside. Like when they start marketing it that way, then I'll know there's some safety actually being the company actually cares at some level.
Right. I think about VPN vendors that are out there. One of them that I have, NordVPN. One of their selling points is that they keep no logs. The idea being that you connect, they keep no logs. So if someone were to subpoena them, they're like, we have no logs. Right. That if there was something that was like that,
it's funny because that's a perfect example. Is it interesting because that's a perfect example. The people that know they want a VPN know that they also want that service, right? Why are you using that for home to get connect between your home and when you're remote?
Oh, NordVPN. It was
trial. Kind of tried out.
Well, seeing whether it was possible, for example, to look at some content from Netflix that wasn't available in the U.S.
I don't want to hear about this.
I don't know if I can't speak to whether I was successful or not.
You're listening to Geek Speak. I'm Lyle Troxell. I'm talking with Miles Elam. Miles, please do tell us all about some terrifying simple code that actually put some people in jail.
The reason why people are in jail is because there was a big roundup in Turkey. There was a failed coup, and so there was a big sweep putting thousands of people in, or tens, maybe hundreds of thousands of people in jail. And so that's what put people in jail.
Of course, it has nothing to do with code. But how was software involved?
Because one of the things they were doing to catch the 150,000 Turks to, you know, get them to lose their jobs, to put them in jail and the like, was because they were using, or what they believed were using, a particular app called Bylock. Mm-hmm. And so they were looking for specific signs that someone had used Bylock. And if they had, off they go.
Wait, just using one app would cause that? That's really...
Like I said, not a... There was a correlation being drawn, but there turns out there's an estimated 30,000 people that were swept up in this who never actually used Bylock. That what they were using as a fingerprint to see whether someone was using it, it was actually triggered through other apps that had nothing to do with Bylock.
Why would other apps be targeting Bylock?
They're not targeting Bylock. It was, I believe, having to do with some ads that were brought down. But it was a 1 pixel
transparent pixel for layout. Yeah, tracking purposes.
Item. Yeah, that for Bylock that was how it used for tracking for multiple areas. But and they thought that was the only place that people would have come across it. But it turns out it was used on some other sites.
It looks like there was a music source called a music app called Frenzy.
Yep.
And that looked up information from the Bynock.net system, effectively.
Right.
We're talking about basically ways of doing data transportation, HTTP requests from one app to another app.
Right. And also apps to look up, you know, prayer times, you know, finding the direction to Mecca.
Mm-hmm.
You know which direction to pray to. So,
so first off, pretty horrible that hundred thousand people were, or I think I saw 30,000 people.
30,000 people were caught up in the sweep that didn't have anything to do with this app that was targeted. 150,000 people total.
The other thing that I don't get, though, is how can an app denote your political affiliation? It seems like that was kind of a misnomer as well.
Bear in mind that this is the Erdogan government. So subtlety is not what they're known for.
Okay.
I mean, this is a guy who came to the U.S. and when people were demonstrating, sicked his bodyguards and started beating up American citizens on American soil. So, you know, if willing to do that and, you know, try to get away with it, why not do it in your own country?
Yeah. Well, pretty scary. I watch probably too many YouTube videos. I like to watch things on blacksmithing. It's kind of what I'm into lately. But for a while, the kids and I watched the slow-mo guys, which are two gentlemen that have had slow-mo cameras for a long time. They jump on, you know, they break water balloons. They, mm-hmm. you know, throw paint in the air. Lots of fun stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
And recently in my feed has been this How TVs Work feed. And I saw it, and I didn't know it was the slow-mo guys. I just saw how TVs work, and I know how TVs work, so I didn't really care. Like, I was like, whatever.
It's and really then, cool when you actually see it, though.
And then a week goes by, and you're like, you send this up for the GeekSpeak link. Describe what this is.
This is showing different television technologies and how they actually appear at the individual pixel level. So it starts off with, for example, Super Mario. And plays on an old CRT.
Cathode ray tube.
Yes, which they define as well. And how that technology works, where it goes from top to bottom and goes from left to right as it's going through
across.
Yeah, scan lines, yeah. And basically, you're exciting the phosphors. They illuminate. And there's it takes some time for those phosphors to then
degrade or fade out.
Yeah, fade out.
Yeah.
So you end up with the. So what you're looking at is this ghosted image that's on there, even though it's drawing, you know, line by line, because it's doing it 60 times a second, or I guess in the cathode ray tube, it's doing it like 24 times a second, something like that. But it is, it looks to us like a solid image, but it's not.
And you've probably seen this before when you videotape a television, or early days of videotaping a television. You saw that the television would have like dark and light bandings and they'd move up and down. Do you ever see that mm-hmm. effect?
Yep.
So that's an example of this. But CRTs, the cathode ray tube, what's happening is there's an electron gun that's just firing electrons straight out. And there's little magnets around that gun that directs the beam in different directions. This is the most common ways of seeing this is a standard oscilloscope. An oscilloscope draws a beam on the screen, and then you excite the beam going different up and down and left and right by the frequencies that are coming in, and you can actually kind of see the waveforms on screen. Mm-hmm. Televisions are the same way. A traditional television is the same way. And it's got a metal mesh in there, a very thin screen with lots of little holes, and there are three guns if it's a color television. And when those hit those holes and they scan through, they're actually hitting the different three colors on the front of the screen, three different colors of phosphorus.
Mm-hmm.
And then they, as you said, they excite and then glow, kind of like if you've ever had stuff that glows in the dark, you hit it with a flashlight and then you turn off the lights and it glows for a while. It's kind of like that stuff.
Yep. Only it glows for, instead of, you know, several minutes, it glows for very small fraction of a second.
And that was the thing that's so cool about seeing the footage after you finally said, see it, look at it. We'll have it up at geekspeak.org, of course. But you can also just look for what Super Mario looks like at 3,800,000 frames, 380,000 frames per second. That it's really neat to see it, like each individual thing light up and how it works. It's
right.
very...
What was also interesting to me is that he went through the different technologies, like the LCD screen that has an LED backlight, like which most of us have on our laptops.
Right.
And how that is not doing those scan lines like what you expect. They're turned on, but you put a macro lens on it to look that much closer to see what it looks like.
All those pixels. And they're not really as uniform as, I mean, they're uniform, but not in a balanced way.
Right. It's not what you would think intuitively.
Yeah.
Looking at it. And then goes on to the organic LED. And
totally
the,
different.
How
like
that technology works.
Like my iPhone X is an OLED.
And so if you want to know how a TV displays items and what the difference is between those two technologies, like why is it worth buying an OLED versus a quote-unquote standard LED, which is LED backlight with an LCD, this is the video to watch.
And so when you say an LCD and a backlight, what you're really saying, liquid crystal display, there's a color element that's transparent, and the white light behind it just translates it through or goes through it and gets blocked by the different color LCDs, right?
Right.
And so the black area on a, like the laptops we both have right now have a backlight. And so if you show black, you actually have to block all that with these these liquid crystals.
Which it doesn't do very well, which means you don't get a true black. You get this dark
grayish
gray.
Black. Yeah, charcoaly black. It looks black to us, but if you really look at it, it doesn't.
Right. And until you look at an OLED display, in which case that's a true black because instead of having a backlight and you're trying to occlude the light, the OLED is its own light source.
Every single pixel is a light.
Right. And so if the light is turned off, it's black.
Yeah. It's pretty cool. You can kind of tell this when you turn on like a phone that does not have that has a backlight in it, an LCD type phone. You'll notice that when it turns on, even before it's done anything, it kind of becomes a lighter darkness.
Yep.
That's the opacity of the white. Really cool. I definitely, it's a fun one to see. It's the slow-mo guys. And actually, if you like cool videos of slow motion stuff, which I love, the slow-mo guys on YouTube is fantastic, fantastic. Miles, tell us about virtual solar power plant.
This comes on the heels of a big battery project that was set up by Tesla in South Australia. That they set up a big battery, bank of batteries, and then if there's ever any power, then if there's ever any power shortage, with regard to the overall grid, which is coal powered or oil powered, then the batteries could make up that difference, smooth out the highs and lows. And if you can smooth out the highs and lows, because batteries can give that power a lot quicker to fill in that gap than trying to ramp up production on a coal system, then you can make the coal system or the other parts more efficient.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, pretty much any time you need to match domain with something that is giant spinning pieces of metal, which is all turbine systems, which is nuclear, water-based, wind-based, and coal. Those are all just going to push turbines. Mm-hmm. You have to overproduce power to match the need that you currently have. With batteries, it's not like that. You can actually provide the power that's needed.
Batteries have their losses, but there's also that scaling problem. That was what was impressive about this installation.
Big.
Yeah, it's
humongous. Buildings and buildings size of battery.
But this is the next step where now they're talking about using 50,000 homes in South Australia and putting a whole bunch of solar panels on each of them, and it becomes a virtual solar power plant. So if you have the battery backup along with it, and then you have the solar panels on there, just on individual houses, the people are, to install the panels is apparently free. It's similar to what SolarCity does out here.
It's a long-term lease where you get...
Right. You're paying what is typically, market prices for electricity. So you don't have to pay for the solar panel to be on your house, but then you pay your monthly bill, as opposed to you buy the solar panels yourself, and then you just have to recoup the cost because you're having a lower electricity bill over the course of 10, 20 years.
So they're doing this pattern where they're like, let's make the solar panels at the houses.
Yeah,
and then plug them into
a truly decentralized grid. Yeah,
I mean the thing, of course, that also makes sense that if you have generation, the closer you have generation, the more efficient it is. So during the day, if you do run your washing machine, dryer, and you have your solar panels running at that time, there's very little loss on using that power. If you have it, 4 miles away, you're going to have some loss on those lines. So the closer you can get, the better. And then, of course, the problem of, like, what happens at night? Well, you've got a battery backup nearby, which is really, it's very cool. Very cool endeavor.
Plus, you also have the existing power infrastructure. Sure. So that still ties into the grid, but yeah.
In general,
you don't have a single power plant. You actually have a few in the area, and they're all mixing in.
What's the plan for recycling solar panels on people's homes? There's a whole bunch of heavy metals everywhere. Is there plans for that? Because, like, right now they have 20-year lifespans, right?
Wait, a whole bunch of heavy metals.
Solar panels have heavy metals, yeah. I can find out the material that's in them.
I knew that the construction of them had had some issues, but I wasn't aware that the panels themselves, I mean, those are mostly silicon. There's semiconducting wafers.
Well, maybe I'm misled in my knowledge. It's happened before a few times. Many solar panels contain lead and cadmium.
Okay.
Yeah. They're being phased out, so those are older versions. They're getting better.
Yeah, because the photoelectric effect doesn't require, you know, exotic materials. Obviously, you want to have more efficient panels, and I'm not an expert in, like, what's involved there, but it didn't seem to me that the newer ones had major problems in that way.
Yeah. It's so interesting because it's really hard to find good knowledge on this kind of stuff because, of course, there is a large group of people very interested in you not getting engaged in solar panels. Like, that exists. Like, that's a real thing. There's a coal industry that's like, don't do that. And so any information you've got to do, you've got
to administration really that wants to put 30% tariff onto Chinese solar imports.
Yeah. You definitely have to really know your sources. That's a trick. Oh, that was Tesla, by the way, that did the batteries, right?
Yes.
Tesla's actually doing that. And one of the big purposes of that,
Or the solar roofs, yeah.
Solar roofs. But aren't they also doing the battery part?
They did.
Yeah.
That was already a story that we covered, where they wanted to do it within... if they were saying, like, we're going to build it in 100 days, and if we don't, then it's free. And they got it done like 40 days early or
That's
something
cool.
ridiculous like that.
All right. Looks like we got a little story about Bitcoin and the big banks. What's going on?
Well, this comes on the heels of Bitcoin is on a downward trajectory. It dropped at the $7,000 a Bitcoin level, which is a far cry from the 19,000, I believe, was at its peak at the end of last year.
Yeah, in December or something, it got really big.
Yeah.
So I keep on thinking Bitcoin, like, we talk about Bitcoin as if it represents all of, you know, cryptocurrency.
Right, and it does.
Because it's the grandfather of them at some level, right?
Right.
But it has such horrible inefficiencies because of the way that it produces, like, it's like an energy-wasting tool. That's what it's for. So I know there's other cryptocurrencies. I really do need to have a cryptocurrency expert on to find out if there's any that are actually not put as much hardware as possible at it and therefore waste as much energy to make it.
Well, I'm pretty sure Litecoin fits that bill.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's other ones, and there's Ethereum is another big one, I guess. Mm-hmm. So the market's kind of crashed lately. It's like in the last week or so, it's gone down to 7,000?
It's been steadily going down for a while since its peak, but yeah, it's definitely gone down from it, and it's to the point where banks now, like JP Morgan Chase, Bank of America, Citi, are now barring people from buying Bitcoin with a credit card, which makes
a good idea.
Yes, I mean, people were treating Bitcoin like a safe investment, and mm-hmm. it's like a volatile stock.
When it was in that peaky, like, crazy frenzy place in November and December, I remember people talking about, how's the time to get into currency? I'm like, no, 5 years ago is when you could get into cryptocurrency
right.
and make money.
It was very much but like 2005, where people were like, you got to buy your house now, or you're going to miss out on the market. And so you really don't want to buy then.
Yeah, yeah. So, I know that people are doing a lot of trading on it, and I guess what's happened is people started using their credit cards, and then, of course, people go get – I mean, why isn't a bank okay with them using a credit card to buy something? I mean, if I wanted to go buy a whole bunch of shoes and I only have 2 feet, but I want to buy like $10,000 of shoes, I could put that on my credit card. Why does it matter what I spend money on? Like, why do the banks care?
They're concerned about the volatility and risk involved. With regard to shoes, like, that's on an individual basis. You have a person saying, yeah, okay, I'm going to buy some shoes. But overall in society, not all those many people are going to be putting themselves in debt over shoes.
Right.
Not everyone is in Imelda Marcos. But with regard to...
I guess this is like clearly a financial leverage scheme is what people are trying to do. And so the banks are like, whoa, that doesn't seem like a good investment.
Yeah, how credit cards are working is we're going to give you this money up front, the expectation that you'll be able to pay us back, hopefully not the whole bit all at once, but enough that you could, you know, pay us out and we can make a profit. But there has to be the expectation you're going to pay it back. If you have a large number of people who are putting a huge amount of money, the real money that the bank is fronting, or at least the credit card companies are fronting, to go into these cryptocurrencies, and that wealth evaporates, the person, their ability to pay back that debt and their likelihood of declaring bankruptcy and then the banks not getting their investment back greatly increases. So with the drop, you're going to see a lot more people becoming much more conservative with how they deal with cryptocurrencies, which we've already been seeing.
Yeah, I can imagine that. I'm curious, though, if the full protection of credit card purchases is part of the problem. So when I purchase something with my ATM or with cash, at the end of that transaction, that money be gone. But with a credit card, I can actually say, nope, I didn't get the service. And credit cards actually have a pretty strong support for the consumer, such that, you know, if you're buying stuff online, use a credit card. Don't use your ATM, right? Because if somebody messes with you, you can just say, nope, I dispute the charge. So I'm wondering if that's also part of the problem, that if you dispute when the market falls for Bitcoin and you can't get that money back, what's the dispute situation looks pretty bad. Basically, I guess you could kind of game the market by that in that way.
Yeah.
I think actually that the agency, the Bitcoin exchange systems are doing such that if you buy with credit card, you are locked into that rate, but you can't actually do anything about it for a certain period of time until the charges can't be distributed anymore. I think that's how they're actually dealing with it.
Oh my. Bitcoin, as I'm seeing a live update of Bitcoin prices, it's actually nearing 6,000.
Yes, it's at 6,000 right now. Change of 828 in the last 24 hours.
Jeez. Okay, then.
I mean, I'm laughing. I shouldn't laugh. I know people are heavily invested in this and are engaged in it. I recall, though, in that December period, people were like, oh, yeah, I have some Bitcoins. I'm like, sell them right now. Like, why aren't you selling them? In any case, I've promised this before, but I will have some people on about Bitcoin. The actual methodology of blockchain and the potential different uses for it are a much more interesting thing to me than the actual financial dealings with it. There's some cool technologies that emerge from that.
Yeah, pattern. Blockchain is basically a distributed database.
Yeah.
That in order for it to work, everyone has to have a copy of the entire transaction chain, which is why Bitcoin is so slow and so resource intensive.
Yeah, Bitcoin's like 13 terabytes, something like that. It's just this massive thing. It's really big at this point. I should look up the number. How big is the blockchain? Have you ever done any Bitcoin stuff?
No.
Why not?
By the time that I would have really tried, I was already seeing numbers where when it was at 500, I was going, I'm not seeing the basis for why this should be $500. I am, especially from the lessons of the housing bubble of the mid-2000s, which I was thankfully able to avoid, was this notion of putting your money someplace and you just get free money. The wealth without work. Every time I see that now, I have this little buzz go off in the back of my brain going, something's wrong. And so with regard to Bitcoin, when I first heard about it, it was a novelty. And had I cared a little bit more, I might have done something just to try it out, just to see what it was about. But I was interested in other things. But as it grew and as I started seeing, like, people are using this as an investment tool, you put money in and your money just grows, the alarm bells started going off.
Yeah. So it's not as big as I thought. In August of 2014, the entire chain itself, all transactions, got to 20 gigabytes. In January 2015, the size had grown to almost 30 gigabytes. From January 2016 to January 2017, the blockchain grew from 50 gigabytes to 100 gigabytes. So we're kind of in the upper 100 gigabytes. That's not that big. I mean, it's still big. But
these are hashes, so not very compressible.
No, not compressible at all. Like, randomness is the worst to compress. Huh, interesting.
So yeah, if for the same reason of, like, you don't go to Vegas, like, to spend money, spend your rent money. Like, if you want to gamble, that's fine.
Miles, like, but it's dropped that much recently, now's the time to buy some Bitcoin. You should grab $100 and go buy some right now.
But yeah, it's that notion of if you don't have the money, don't go gambling with it.
Yeah.
If you do have the money, it's up to you. Whatever you think is going to give you some enjoyment. Yeah.
Yeah, sure. I mean, it's basically day trading, right? All right, we got one more story for today, and it's probably a big one. Talk to me about AI.
Well, this is one topic that we've talked about quite a bit. The notion of AI, artificial intelligence, isn't bad. It's the people behind it, the assumptions we make behind it, that are the problematic parts. And so really what I want to do is just point people toward our website. Please look up this article. I think it's a really interesting read to know what you're getting into. The poll quote that I got from it was, AI models hold a mirror up to us. They don't understand what we really don't they don't understand when we really don't want honesty. They will only tell us polite fictions if we tell them how to lie to us ahead of time. We have a lot of assumptions.
This article that you're mentioning is on Medium. It's by Yotan Zunger. And he actually looks like there's an audio version of it as well.
Yeah, Yonatan Zunger. Yeah.
So what's the meaning behind that quote, do you think?
The idea is that we have biases in our society. Like, we are not neutral, as much as we like to think of it. Because we grow up in the society, we don't think about many of the aspects. In fact, that's why a lot of people love traveling, is because you have some of your preconceived notions, you know,
broken down a little bit. You look at them again. Yeah.
Yeah. Your assumptions about how things should be are suddenly questioned. Mm-hmm. And suddenly when you're doing stuff, you like, oh, wait, I'm actually really weird by doing that. Oh, yeah. And so with that comes all of the photos that we take, the choice of things that we have in there, the news headlines that are present. So if you have aspects of your society such as racism or sexism, then the default model that gets put into the AI, if you're just throwing in the headlines that you see, you're going to have an AI that's slightly racist or slightly sexist or very racist or very sexist, depending upon your point of view. There's also going to be the cases where you're identifying photos, and what a human being sees and what the computer sees are two different things. And it may not be because of anything nefarious. It's just the way that our human minds work is going to be different than just a strict algorithmic model. Like, the example given in the article, I'm not spoiling too much, is that there's a picture of six cats. And in the top row, you know, when you look, you go like, oh, those are gray cats, and the ones on bottom are white cats. But correctly so, the computer identified the top three as a group because the cats were sitting on carpet, whereas the bottom cats were not sitting on carpet. They were either on grass or on pavement. So the things that it focused on were different, the things that they immediately picked out. And that's a function of culture. It may be a function of just how the human pattern recognition works, because we care more about the animate object, the cat, because of a threat model than we would evolutionary threat model.
Right.
Than the what they're laying in.
I mean, the aspect of this that's important to understand is that when we analyze the world and we look at the world, we are bringing with us an entire history of knowledge about things. We are bringing texture to it. You know, we understand the embodiment of what that cat is, not just a visual pixel mapping, not just a flat image. We have a whole bunch of stuff around that. Great examples of this is our humor and our puns, our language things that change from culture to culture. Computers aren't doing these deep learning algorithms that are just a big wave right now in artificial intelligence don't do any of that kind of stuff. They are simply mapping what is seen, and I wouldn't even say seen, what is analyzed pixel to pixel in groupings with small algorithms on top of each other with feedback systems.
Yeah, maybe extrapolating lines or textures.
And they do an amazing job, and it's very similar to part of our the way our brains work at some level. But they are not representational. They're not thinking. They're not engaged in the world like we are. And the thing that's troublesome about this is that they're really good at part of this thing that we like, and they're getting better at it. But in no way is that approaching anything like the way we see. And in fact, it's going to feed back into our society and change the way we look at the world, as all technology does.
Right. And I love the fact that this article brought up morality and the fact that there are some questions we don't want to ask, but there are decisions that are going to need to be made. For example, if you're in a car...
The trolley problem.
Yes, the trolley problem. But I mean, you're in a car and there is a...
A little kid runs out in the middle of the street.
Exactly.
The car can swerve, killing everybody in the car, or kill the kid.
Right. And if it's just yourself, many people would be like, there's that question of like, are you able to sacrifice yourself for that child? But what happens if you have your own kid in the car? That calculus changes. What happens if it's someone who is an adult and is the kid worth more than the passenger you have? With regard to a self-driving car, one, they're better drivers than we are.
Right. There's going to be already so few deaths that it's worth the not knowing what the answer to this question is, almost, right?
Right. But
the truth is that most people
won't
make
it. It is possible for it to happen. It is possible
for
there be an occluding wall or something like that the LiDAR can't see through.
And the trouble is that it's not like, well, I hope the person makes the right decision. No, we're going to code what the right decision is, so we need what it is. Like,
right.
If I'm the developer doing that, I want somebody else to kind of weigh in on this. I don't want to be like, if greater than 3, you know?
Yeah, like, can the LiDAR detect how old the person is? Like, does that go into the factor? Do you swerve for the 5-year-old but not the 105-year-old?
And if you only do it by height, then wouldn't you slowly evolve a species that was shorter?
Well, assuming that the scenario were that much faster and you caught people before they had children. Yeah. But yeah.
No, I mean that if shorter people were more likely to be a child and the car rated children better as more valuable, then shorter people would also be avoided by the cars. And over time, you would have less tall people that survive.
But as I said, the tallness, that has to be like they have to have not had kids before they got hit.
Before they got tall.
Yeah, otherwise...
Oh, even it's, or, even yes, a small percentage, tall, enough time. If you give it enough time, even a small percentage would affect the species. That's all I'm saying. So the question here is the moral question. Like, you have to figure that out. You have to answer that question.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't been great about planning things like that in the past.
Right, and because there are questions that we like to punt on, we treat them as, this is spur of the moment, this is your gut reaction, and you can't do that, as you said, with an AI. It does raise questions also about what happens if we put AI in charge of other things like finance.
We already have put AI in charge of finance.
But I mean, in terms of like public policy, like determining what taxation rates should be like, or what penalties should be like for avoiding taxes, or something like that, because those decisions can very much. It can often directly result in stress-induced death or suicide. Finances are one of the biggest drivers of those. And so if you have an AI that's doing that, do you take in, like, what's the likelihood of someone going to, of a certain number of people going to commit suicide or having a heart attack versus a lower economic output?
I think the indirect stuff is a little harder for us to make decisions off of. The more direct stuff is easier for us to know what's important. I mean, given the, aspect...
Well, the direct stuff is what we were just talking about of what happens if someone jumps in front of the car.
Yes.
And that's not easy. You're saying that's an easier problem, and
that's it's an easier thing to think about. It's an easier thing to figure out. Mm-hmm. I mean, granted, it's hard judgment call and what is more valuable, what human life is more valuable and all of those things. But trying to say, well, if this financial system is too good at their job, someone in Nebraska is going to commit suicide, so make sure that that doesn't happen, so don't be as good. That's too indirect for us to actually comprehend. Now, I think that probably AIs might get it better at that.
Too indirect from... Well, the thing is, we can already do that with statistics. It's just that...
Yeah.
When you have an AI do it, we're not going to be concerned about that variable, or if you do, you have to be aware of what the drawbacks are.
You're kind of saying the paperclip problem AI, right? Where you give a task to an AI and you say, do that. The most important thing you could possibly do is make paperclips. Just do that the most efficiently as possible. And if you let that thing go, it will take over all matter in the universe and make it paperclips, right?
Right.
So there is that aspect. What you're trying to say is that if you have a financial trading institution system, when you put it in place, you should give it some ethical charge as well to make sure that it doesn't do harm in other ways. And I'm just saying that harm in other ways is so abstract when you're talking about financial transactions, it's very hard to give it to all the input of that sense. It's too grand a problem, unless I didn't understand what you're talking about. Suicides of financial trading.
That's okay. Fine. It's just that we already are putting AI into a lot of areas that maybe you wouldn't think of ahead of time.
Sure.
And so it's worthwhile thinking about what are the potential consequences and are we really ready to make those choices about how much a human life is worth? Because that's really what we're talking about, whether it's on the micro or the macro scale.
Yeah. Well, I mean, the trolley car situation with self-driving cars is clearly not really a problem because even if you do it randomly, you are so much less likely to die being a passenger or a pedestrian around these vehicles that it is better for society. A lot less people will die.
Sure.
So it's kind of like, well, it doesn't really matter what the decision-making is. If the decision-making is, I think I'm going to hit something, just brake. Don't swerve, don't do anything, just brake. It's still better than what we have right now.
It will if a sufficient number of people think that when that accident does happen, however rare it may become, and the choice made was different than their personal sensibilities prefer or would lead to, there's where the conflict comes into play.
Yeah.
Because if you don't trust the systems... As we're seeing right now, if you don't trust the systems, if you don't trust the institutions, a lot of other things, as we've seen in recent news, tend to break down as a result of that.
True. GeekSpeak is a registered service mark of David Lawrence's user permission, and GeekSpeak is Creative Commons Attribution 3.0. You can use our stuff any way you'd like. You can even make money on it. Just give us some credit. My name is Lyle Troxell. The theme song from today's show, and almost every day's show, is by Michael Newman of Pet Star Music. The title, Japanese Teapot Map Super Mario, is by Greg Merkley, our Canadian correspondent. I'm Lyle Troxell, and I want to thank Miles Elam for joining us today.
Always a pleasure.